History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme...
Very often the only opportunity they had was to get at a German who they happened to be living in their midst.
Anti-German paranoia during World War I and the so-called German plot also.
He took part in a raid on the enemy's trenches in front of Avion on the night of June 9th, 1917.
The forensic sculptor who reconstructed the skull of an Irishman who died during World War I. Plus the golden years of haute cuisine in 20th century Dublin. And that's where we begin. In the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of talk about the 14-year correspondence between Jackie Kennedy and Father Joseph Leonard of Vincentian, who lived at All Hallows in Drumcondra. Jackie sent dozens of handwritten letters to the priest both before and after she married JFK. In her first letter, which was written in August 1950, Jackie fondly recalled dining at Jamet's French restaurant on her recent visit here. Its menu reflected its status as Ireland's finest.
Jamet's, 4th of November 1961. Carte du jour. Smoked salmon, 10 shillings. House pâté, 5 shillings. Galway oysters, 11 shillings. Seasoned snails, 8 shillings and sixpence. Caviar, £1, 10 shillings. Grapefruit, 2 and threepence. Other hors d'oeuvre variés may be obtained on request, subject to availability and delay.
Right, that was when the average industrial wage was £4. Well, after Jackie Kennedy, 51551 is our text number, by the way. After Jackie Kennedy married the US Senator John F. Kennedy, they visited here in 1955. And of course, they dined at Jamet's or Jamet's at number 46 Nassau Street. I'm joined by Dr. Máirtín Macanamara, lecturer in culinary arts at the Dublin Institute of Technology, and Elaine Mahon, who is currently researching Irish diplomatic dining. Máirtín, we'll get on to Jackie Kennedy in a minute. But first of all, the pronunciation. Are we calling it Jamet's or are we calling it Jamet's?
Well, it all depends. As I say, it's the Jamet family and some of the Jamet family are still alive and well here. So we'll call it Jamet's, but the Dubs do call it Jamet's. But also some of the lads I've spoke to who train there would call it Jammies.
Jammies.
You know? And even they said that sometimes, that fella's really jammy. You know, he's really lucky, you know what I mean?
So that's where it comes.
Well, that's what I heard. Now, I haven't heard. Maybe there's some listeners out there who have.
So if you are a jammy,
an etymology for being a jammy so-and-so, you know? So I've heard that explanation given. So
okay, you were talking about a restaurant which dates back to 1901 and the Nassau Street incarnation opens in 1927. Snow white linen, monogrammed porcelain, cut crystal, a world away from what is going on around it in the 1920s, I would have thought.
Yeah, well, absolutely, to one extent. Naturally, there was, if you still looked at Grafton Street, was still selling all the best ware and there were all the great shops and there were still good theatres and everything going on. So naturally, restaurants was a part of that and hotels were a part of that. So restaurants sort of appeared in Dublin really in the middle of the 19th century. They started to appear as sort of restaurants and there was... On that site in Andrew Street, it was originally the Burlington restaurant. Now, what happened is that the Jamet brothers took it over in 1901. And again, they ran it to 1927 there in Andrew Street, Church Lane, which is the lease reverted back to the Hibernian Bank. And then they had to move. So they took over another restaurant that had been in, it was Kids Restaurant on Nassau Street. They took that over in 1927. And they operated then till 1967.
Nice. Yeah. For 40 years in Nassau Street. And the clientele was described as la crème de la crème. Who are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking about the great and the good. You know, when they were opened up originally, they advertised to the nobility and, you know, the gentry and the magistracy and all, and in the magistrate's guide. And there was, you know, all of these sort of people. All the, say, the dons of Trinity College would have eaten there. The top businessmen would have eaten there. The clergy, the whole lot would have eaten there. But then you had all the actors coming as well and all the playwrights and all that sort of stuff. Like, you had people like, I suppose, Brinsley McNamara, James Stevens, Lennox Robinson, you know, Seamus O'Sullivan, Patrick O'Donovan, Francis Stewart, all these sort of people.
W.B. Yeats had his own table.
He had his own table, yeah, the Yeats table, yeah. Absolutely. There's a beautiful picture of it, actually. It was in Queen magazine, 1967. It's actually on, it's the front cover of Alison Maxwell's book on Jamet's, Jamet's of Dublin, is that picture of, I think it is, it's Lady Longford and Pádraig Cullum and one other person, I can't remember now, they're sitting at Jamie's at the AIDS table, yeah.
And what's there now? What's on the site
it's
now?
It's the porterhouse now, but it's gone through a number. When it closed down first, then it became the Burnie Inn.
Right.
You know, and then it became...
The Burnie Inn, I remember.
Yeah, after the Burnie Inn, it was a Mexican place. I can't remember the name of it now. And then it's now Porterhouse Central.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. Before its Nassau Street incarnation, you mentioned that it was in Andrew Street and started there in 1901 by the French brothers François and Michel. What possessed them to think that a French restaurant would take root in Dublin in 1901?
They were asked to open it, basically, because Michel himself, he worked for Lord Cadogan, you know, in the Viceregal Lodge up in the Phoenix Park, now Ars and Uachtaran, and he was basically the head chef at the court in Dublin Castle. So he would have been, he cooked for Queen Victoria when she came in 1900. She would have catered for him, or he would have catered for her, should I say. And so basically all of the gentry would have asked, there was sort of a lack or a need for such a place in Dublin, and they were begged to open it. So he asked his brother to come over, who was in one of the best places in Paris called Bœuf à la Mode, François, and they opened this, and it was a rolling success.
And how did it fare at times like the lockout in 1913, or more particularly, I suppose, the 1916 Rising, when there might have been bombs and bullets flying around?
Yeah, it stayed open. See, they would have had... The secret there is they would have had people living upstairs. A lot of the chefs and waiters and stuff would have lived upstairs in the building. It was actually originally a hotel as well. It was the Jamais restaurant and hotel up until 1927. Now, when it went to when it moved from Andrew Street, the hotel part left. But that part, I've no first-hand sort of comments from there, but I spoke to another, say, foreigner, a Belgian, Zenon Geldof. I spoke to his son, who's now, God rest him, he's dead, Herbert. He was known as Sonny. And now this is Bob Geldof's grandfather.
Yeah.
He came over in 1909. And he, during, you're talking about 1916, he was in Jury's Hotel. Now, Jury's Hotel was there on Dame Street, where I think it's Bloom's
right
Hotel now.
Right beside the Central Bank.
That's right. And that was the old Jury's, as they call it. He was there during the... during the 1916 the whole thing there is he lived out in Sandymount, and I heard, like, his son was able to tell me that he needed special passes and all that sort of stuff to make his way around. He happened to be down actually in Crosshaven down in during the Civil War, and there were great stories about both sides of the Civil War coming in, drinking after hours, and then going off into the... So there was little sort of truce, you know, in the sort of a she bean in the Crosshaven Hotel, you know, and with the Belgian servant.
Now, it's moving to Nassau Street in the late, mid to late 1920s, Elaine. And would the new Irish state, if it was entertaining diplomatic visitors, would it bring those diplomatic visitors to a place like Jamais, or would it have other means of entertaining them?
Well, in the beginning, from about 1922 onwards, we see that the Irish state starts to record the arrival of what they call distinguished guests or distinguished visitors. But they don't actually do any official entertaining. What they do is the odd kind of unofficial luncheon or dinner, etc. But what they did do in... They did hold, actually, an official event, if you like, in 1928. President Cosgrave had travelled to Paris to sign the Kellogg Anti-War Pact, and he travelled back with Frank Kellogg to Dublin. In August 1928, and they held a state dinner for him in the Shelburne in August that year. And there was about 100 guests, and they had a very fancy French menu. And the dinner was from 7 p.m. until about 9:30, and then they went to the Plaza in Abbey Street, where there was a state reception for about 2,000 guests there.
The Plaza in Abbey Street. Tell me more. Does anybody know anything about the Plaza in Abbey Street?
The Plaza is quite amazing because it's where the Adelphi Cinema used to be.
Right.
And which is now
Middle Abbey Street.
And what I found amazing about it is that it opened, I think it's 1926 or 27, I have the dates, but that it opened, it could sit between 500 and 1,000 people for lunch or for dinner. And this is, you know, just be, you know, you're after the, you know, in between the two wars, just before the Wall
Presumably
Street crash.
Presumably had dancing floor show, you know, resident orchestra,
they,
all
they
that
had
kind of
all,
stuff.
All of that sort of stuff. And not just that, like you had there, but you also had Cleary's. You had all these big restaurants, you know, that could sit, you know, that would do lunches for up to over 1,000 people a day. So there was a regular dining clientele in the plaza, but it didn't last all that long. Naturally, the Wall Street crash would have had a big effect on it. It also had problems getting, it also problem getting actually a licence, which is interesting because I think, Elaine, you might talk
that's
about
that. That's right, that's right. On the evening of the state reception for Mr Kellogg, we see that the Dolphin Hotel Limited supplied, I think it's 3 cases of champagne and various bottles of wine, etc., to the plaza, because it turns out, I believe, that the plaza didn't actually have a...
Yeah, going through newspaper reports, you find from time to time the plaza up in court for actually serving alcohol without a licence, you know what I mean?
It doesn't have an alcohol licence.
There was, I think the local, you know, vintners were up in arms because they were afraid with such a big place with alcohol that it would hoover all the...
Well, you can understand that.
The business away from them, you know?
And could you bring your own? I mean,
I think they served it regularly. They finally got it, you know, but there was all these. But that, interesting, that was run by, that was the general manager was Zenon Geldof, and he brought over a team of French chefs over from the Ritz in Paris.
Right. By the way, Judge Roy Beans was the restaurant.
Judge Roy Beans is a Mexican one.
The Bernie Inn. So, the hanging judge from the Old West, a little bit different from Jamais. Now, over a number of years, Restaurant Jamais maintained its position as Dublin's finest. Then, in 1949, a man called Pierre Roland was appointed as head chef of something called the Russell Restaurant. What was that all about and how did that change things?
Well, it changed things big time because the Russell opened up. There's a family called the Besson family. Now, we talked about Paul Besson came over in 1909 and he came over as manager of the Royal Hibernian, which is on Dawson Street, where the Royal Hibernian
Insurance
arcade is now, as such. You know, that there was a great hotel there for, you know, it was from 1770 or so up to 1984. But he took that over then after a period of time, and he also had the Bailey. And then he bought the Russell. Now, the Russell had been a temperance restaurant, or a temperance hotel. It was on the corner.
It didn't need a licence.
It didn't need a licence, but he changed it very much. He turned it from a temperance, you know, hotel into one of the fanciest restaurant and hotels in not only in Ireland, but also in the world. Because, for example, in 1963, when Egon Rone first covered Ireland, they couldn't get over. Like, it got, you know, 3 stars. And then when they came back, they
three
said...
Three out of a possible...
Well, no, the top, it was the most you could get, you know what I mean? And they were basically saying that this is... You know, I heard this is one of the best places in Ireland, but this is not only the best place in... It's definitely one of the best places in the world. You know, it was of that calibre, completely of that calibre. He brought over this fella, Pierre Roland, as a chef. And then Pierre then trained. His son was with him, and Henri Roland... And they trained a whole generation of people. Like, I trained in Cahill Brewer Street.
And is the rugby referee descended from them?
He is. Alan, yeah. Alan is the son of Henri.
And this is where the government chose, the Russell now, this is where the government chose to entertain John F. Kennedy on his visit here. Was that the 1963 visit?
That's 1963, what happened there was they didn't hold the state dinner in the Russell. The Russell catered for the state dinner in Ivy House on the night, and there was again, you know, a state dinner followed by a state reception. So the Russell catered for the dinner, and the Civil Service Dining Club, which had been set up in the 50s and was located just around the corner from Ivy House, they actually did the state reception that evening for a larger group of people.
And what kind of menu? I mean, I think the Russell was suggesting something a little bit ritzier than
ritzier, a very, very fancy classic French menu, and they had things like a double consommé with profiteroles, and they had lots of things like, you know, a creme of Florida avocat soup, and quite fancy and heavy fare, I guess. And JFK's aides decided that because he had such a busy schedule that they'd like a slightly simpler menu. And the Department of External Affairs, along with the aides, came to decide on a menu of Irish smoked salmon, tournado. They had strawberries and cream for dessert. So it was quite a much simpler menu, but probably quite elaborate because it was still the Russell, you know, it was still Pierre Roland.
Still catered by this. Oh, he was still there at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he did actually do the menu and do the catering on the night. And you see him as listed as head chef on the access list of visitors for the night of the dinner.
Now, Martin, Jackie wasn't with JFK on the visit in 1963 because she was pregnant, but you met and you shook hands with her on another occasion. Tell us about that.
Now, I managed to spend the summer of 1988 over in Hyannisport, working for the Kennedys in the Kennedy compound. I worked for Ethel, which was Robert's wife and the family. But one day on the jetty, I used to look after them when they'd gone sailing and help with different bits and pieces. One day on the jetty, anyway, Jackie was coming in, and I held her hand as she was getting off her boat onto the jetty, which is lovely. And there was an aura about her. She was thin and that, but there was definitely an aura about her.
Very classy individual. I look forward to reading your memoir of that summer. That alone would be worth reading. There was an interesting development in the early 1950s when the Irish Transport and General Workers Union agreed to allow foreign-born chefs and waiters to work in Ireland in return for Irish apprentices being trained. That had quite an impact, didn't it?
Big time. This is same fella, Ken. We're talking here now about Ken Besson from the Royal Hibernian. He basically realised that the standards in Irish hotels and restaurants was very poor. And he actually brought a delegation from the union over to experience food on the continent and service on the continent, and then got an agreement then to indenture young Irish boys and to train them to bring in the foreign chefs and waiters to do this training, and they were allowed to stay for a certain period of time. And then when this new generation was trained, they took over and they had all the skills. And I was saying that earlier on, that I trained in Cathal Brewer Street. The guys who trained me would have trained under these guys in the Russell, in the Royal Hibernian, and they were very, very professional. They're great guys.
You talk about this period as being the golden age of Dublin dining. Why is that?
Well, it's the golden age because at that time there was more, first fine dining establishments winning prizes operating in Dublin at that time than at any other time up until recently. Like, it's only recently now that, Guibos arrived in 1981, but we didn't actually get a star until, like a Michelin star. Michelin came in 1974, the same year that the Russell closed. It got a star, the Russell got a star, but the next star wasn't until around 1986 or so when Guibos gets one. And then later on, it's nearly in the 2000s, or the 90s, 2000s, when suddenly it goes mad, with Bon Appetit and with, Thornton's and all of these places, Chapter One.
And Elaine, the diplomatic dining, was the pattern then from the 60s onwards, was the pattern to have everything in Ivy House and to have famous restaurants catering it, or what was the pattern?
We see, I suppose, from the end of the 40s onwards, we see an awful lot of state functions being held in Ivy House. But Ivy House also has a certain capacity. It, can only hold a certain amount of people. So when state receptions would get very big, then you'd see the state entertaining elsewhere. Like in 1961, there's the visit of Princess Grace and Prince Rainier of Monaco, and there is a reception held in Dublin Castle for a little over 1,000 people. So it would depend really on the size. Ivy House is certainly kitted out to receive guests. You see the whole housekeeping section, listing all the purchases of plates and glassware and tableware that they're going to need for all their receptions. And you certainly see it going on, but it really depends on the size and, I guess, who's going to be coming to town.
I think we'll have to come back to this subject and talk about some of the other restaurants other than Jamais. And I suppose we've talked a lot about the Russell as well. But Máirtín McInamara and Elaine Mann, you'll be among the speakers at the forthcoming Dublin Gastronomy Symposium, which will be held at the Dublin Institute of Technology on the 3rd and 4th of June. A great lineup awaits. Go to our website for full details and for registration. And a couple of texts. I remember the red curtain in Jamais' window. As kids, we always commented as we passed on the tram or indeed on the bus. And somebody else texted to say, I live in the so-called inner city and we called it Jamais, silent tea. We are not all ignoramuses. A neighbour of ours supplied all fowl to this and to other hotels, including the Russell. And that's from Esther Highland in Dublin Seville. Máirtín and Elaine, thank you again very much.
Thank you.